And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to talk today to David Hoyle of the European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. And our listeners may know that had a mysterious bombing last week where a munitions plant was attacked apparently by the Israelis. And I say apparently, it seems to be general agreement, but it's one of those fog of war situations where, or at least in terms of propaganda, where nobody's exactly being explicit, but it's a story we'd like to make sure everybody is aware of. So, and David Hoyle is has a great website, espac.org, and where you can get the background of these matters. And also today we're going to talk to Ehad Lutayev to get further information on the story of the Estelle, which the Israelis boarded in international waters. And among the members, former members of parliament, there must have been five or six on the ship. He was from Canada, former NDP federal member from British Columbia, and Jim Manley, and so we're going to be talking to Ehad Lutayev about what he we've been learning so far. By the way, Ehad Lutayev has written a very good opinion piece that got published in National Post. National Post wrote, as you would expect, a couple of articles attacking the Jim Manley and others, and Lutayev, who happens to be a poet as well as an activist, wrote an excellent response. And so we're going to have him fill us in. He discussed kind of important, this nomenclature becomes very important here. Use of the word blockade, what is a blockade, who is permitted to establish blockades, because blockades can lead to war. People have heard about the War of 1812. That's led to a war, blockading people's ports. Later on, we will also we want to talk about what is going on with Syria, the developments there, and the visit of the Emir of Qatar. If he's a king, I apologize. But anyhow, we will talk to Zafar Ben-Gaish about that. I don't know if Phil, we might get to the World Series. Who knows?
Well, I hope we do.
You have your favorites.
It was a great moment.
It was a. Who is the Carlin? Is a great comedian, right? Who passed on a year. George Carlin. I'm going to join his team. He says how much he disliked football, and he contrasted them, and that's been my experience. On the weekend, I watched an American university football game, which, as you know, they're semi-professional, but I saw a grown man, his face red as a beet, waving his arms and shaking his fist in the face of a large African-American man, probably 20 years old, and he's probably 40, and giving him this just a horrible, humiliating thing. And it's all over this stupid, this highly specialized, oversized people's sport. And I was thinking, and then later I watched the World Series, and I'm thinking of Carlin said, he preferred baseball because he says in football you wear a helmet and you play on a gridiron and you throw bombs. And he says, baseball is played on a field, and you wear a cap.
Wow. And he says, so true. That's
and the goal in baseball is to go home.
Well, George Carlin is always a man of great wisdom.
The guy gets the first base, and the first thing you notice is here's these two very outstanding athletes talking to each other. Yep. The other day, I saw the greatest hitter in baseball, Cabrera, get struck out by this Lincecum, who's having his problems, but who has come in to help his team, though he's not being the starter. He strikes out Cabrera, and Cabrera tips his hat to him.
That's wonderful. I noticed that.
If that had been the NFL, yeah. The coach would have been in his face when he, what are you doing, you know, yeah, go and get in his face. Yeah. Why didn't you trip him? You had a chance to step on his foot. I mean, it's madness compared. And yet, and highly skilled, brilliant
you know, sport. Yesterday's game was played under very poor atmospheric conditions. There's a hurricane going on, right? And it affected the outcome of the game, no mm-hmm. question about it. And that reminds us that we're all mere mortals, right? that it's so we can just do so much, you know, even with yes. all of our great talents and abilities. And it's certainly baseball players found out about it yesterday. There were home runs that might not have been home runs. There were balls that should have been home runs but got blown back in by the wind, right?
And that's what I thought. Yeah. The Pinella's, what's his name? The drive to left, and it just sank right into the hands. Yep. Yeah, no, it was a great experience. I like the fact that the MVP for the playoff series was Scudero, and he's standing there in a storm, rain pouring down. Everybody, all the fans are still there, and his wife standing next to him held up the Venezuelan flag. And I noticed the cameras all said, "Whoa, is there some way we could shoot this picture without her holding that flag?"
I haven't seen
that. There were 12 Venezuelans. They had to comment on it. There were 12 Venezuelans in that game, I think, starting on either side. And a great comment was made by the by the way, we're trying to reach David Hoyle. We want you to know that. We know you also wanted to be brought up to speed on on the World Series. But on that... I think it was either McCarver or Sutcliffe. I don't know who the commentator is. But he said, one thing they say about Venezuelan ball players, if you get one, he will have all the skills necessary to play. They are the best trained ball players that are presently in the major leagues in terms of their starting out and good programs to create ball players like Scudero, who you watch him. And that guy is aware of everything on the field at all times. And if he gets a double, he doesn't lose his mind and forget not to stroll off second base. He's already thinking of the next two or three things he's going to do.
Of course, he played here in Toronto for a few years, and they didn't have the wisdom to re-sign him.
Well, oh, my gosh, there's a bunch of them. No, that's... we're having problems with reaching our brother Hoyle. He's probably much in demand. Let me just fill our listeners in on this. About 5-10 days ago, somewhere in that range, we had this odd episode where the country of Sudan had a major installation attacked, and the government of Sudan said they thought it was Israel, and that they said it was an aerial attack. I mean, that is dramatic. When you have a flyover bombing of a sovereign country without any previous announcement or by your leave or I might be coming. And then they began to be, I thought there'd be a denial, but instead they went into their favorite mode, which is, they call it, ambivalence, strategic ambivalence. And they also, of course, always were reminded that it's the only democracy in the Middle East, they like to say. So apparently democracies don't, they have strategic ambivalence. A democracy attacks another country without a declaration of war, without any prior explanation or any subsequent account of why they might have done that. And so I'd have to say that they seem to, I would call that failing the democracy test. Apparently, it has to include lack of transparency with your own people. Did the people of Israel know that their war machine was going to have an adventure that night? They just do these things for the fun of it.
You know, one of the newspapers here was very helpful by drawing us a map about how easy it would be for Israel to attack in Sudan, and showed the route that an airplane might have followed so it wouldn't have to be caught on anybody's radar and stuff like that.
Well, and now you raise a point. When the Israelis began to talk about whether or not they did it. What they did was they put their their retired bombers mm-hmm. out as the public relations guys, and they started talking about how this would be a good training exercise for an attack on Iran because the distances are the same or maybe a little more. They wanted to show, the guy said, perhaps they were trying to show what they could do. And then we get the comment from the Sudanese government that these planes are very sophisticated aircraft, which is another reminder because part of the MO of Israel, and people have to understand this and should be reminded of it, is that they have weapons superiority. They have the highest grade of everything. So that if you have a nice rifle, they got one that, you know, has a better range and a sharper. And that's all through careful coordination with their special friends, the United States. I mean, we saw Biden and Obama going at it. As a matter of fact, it was so bad that Stephen Colbert made a great satire out of it about how much they could do for Israel, and then how special the relationship is. I mean, and meanwhile, people say, well, why would we have a problem with Arabs? Well, you just told them that they're number two, that they don't rate you, and that you're guaranteeing that your best friend there always has a weapon superiority. So it's kind of, that it's going to be unequal combat if there's combat. And then it turns out there is combat, and it also comes in the middle of the night unannounced, like the attack on Sudan. Now, the further rationalization of the attack, by the way, is that the Sudanese government is friendly to the political leadership of in Gaza, Hamas. And so that makes it okay. In other words, but apparently this rule only applies for them because, for example, there are a lot of people have friends in each other's countries in Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and that becomes an excuse. However, now we're in a position to we're going to move our cards around. We have Ehad Lotayev of Gaza Arc, GazaArc.org. And thanks very much for joining us. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you've written a great piece. I hope everybody will go and find it. By the way, if they go to GazaArc.org, you can see the article I'm going to be referring to. But you were discussing it. There's been a lot of criticism, of course, and you were nobody's surprised at that. In the Canadian political culture, they're not very happy when a ship goes to Gaza with a Canadian aboard. I guess, first of all, I would just ask you if you could bring us up to speed. How is Jim Manley doing, and where is the Estelle, and how would you gauge the success or not of this episode?
Sure. First, let's start with Jim. Jim is back home in Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. He is in good health and in good spirits and very happy and proud of what he has done and always has been since he got back when asked about the difficulties he faced. His traditional answer is that the thing is not about him. It's basically about the people of Gaza and about the suffering of the people of Gaza. So it has been quite a success, actually, the Estelle carrying parliamentarians or retired parliamentarians from four countries among 30 passengers that belong to over seven or eight countries, and really attracted the attention of the world again to the plight of the people of Gaza. Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing regarding here in Canada. Yes, unfortunately, the ruling political party and to a certain extent, others as well, who are mostly right-leaning, have not been happy that a Canadian participated in such a noble effort to bring the attention to the suffering of the people of Gaza, who the world tends to forget again and again, like all of the Palestinians, actually, at this phase of human history. But I would say that with Jim agreeing at his age, at 79 years of age, to to do what he did and be on the Estelle, it really attracted attention and understanding, I would say, from the vast majority of Canadians. Yes, there are the right-wingers, there are the Zionist supporters that will never acknowledge that there is something good that can happen by somebody putting himself in that difficulty to support a people who are treated unfairly by the Israelis in particular, but by the world governments in general that are forgetting about them. Jim and the Estelle mission and our work as the Canadian boat to Gaza and the upcoming project of Gaza's Ark have been attacked during the past few weeks, but really I wouldn't say have been attacked by the majority in any way.
I agree with you.
Or by the majority even of the media, even the mainstream media in this case.
No, I agree. I think, by the way, I think many Canadians are proud of Jim Manley and impressed also with his integrity and his way of addressing the issue, as you pointed out. And we know there is, in fact, general sympathy in Canada, despite the parties all being so quiet on this subject. There's steady incremental gain in sympathy for the situation of the people of Gaza and the people wanting this to be brought to a proper conclusion where the people of Gaza can live like equals with other people. And again, we're speaking to Ehad Lataif, and it's GazaArk.org. I really recommend you go to that site. It's an excellent site, and there are available there many. There are statements in interviews with Jim Manley and others. And I want you to talk a little bit also, if you would, about this the debate, not debate, but a little argument you had with the National Post, clarifying this business of is Gaza occupied or not occupied, or is it a blockade? How do you characterize the situation? Why do you focus on the nomenclature?
And actually, I'm happy to get the chance again to talk about this, because this is one of the dirty games that the Zionists play and Israel plays about Gaza. They tend to try to spread the myth that they have withdrawn from Gaza in 2005, and they've sacrificed so much to withdraw from Gaza. So when you ask, okay, is Gaza then not occupied? Are the Gaza territorial waters? Gaza territorial waters, Israel has no business in them. They come back and say, no, we control those waters according to international law. Basically, the short conclusion, the easy, simple conclusion is that there are no troops on the ground, Israeli troops on the ground in Gaza permanently. That is the only thing that makes it not a full occupation. Mm-hmm. Everything else, all other aspects of Israeli control over Gaza are a typical occupation with an added pain that they try to escape from their responsibility towards the occupied population, which is their responsibility for all the needs of the occupied population. Mm-hmm. And thus, it becomes a ridiculous thing when the argument goes back and forth about, is Gaza occupied, is it not occupied? Whenever it suits them, they say it's not occupied. Whenever it suits them, they say, no, we have control over it, i.e., it is occupied. Yes. The short story is, Gaza is occupied by Israel, and Israel has a free hand doing whatever it wants in Gaza, and it also runs away from its responsibility under international law towards the occupied population of Gaza, which is to give them and provide them with all their livelihood needs. There was a report that was the Israeli government was forced to release, which is it's entitled the Red Line Report, and that report was done by the Israeli government a couple of years ago, actually, but it was only released over the past week or so by orders from the Israeli Supreme Court itself. And that report clearly confirms what we meaning a lot of people who are concerned about the situation in Gaza, have been saying for a long, long time, which is that Israel, it's true, Israel doesn't prevent goods from entering Gaza to the extent where the people in Gaza would have bloated stomachs and die of starvation, because that's not in its interest. But at the same time, by the same token, Israel drew this red line to stay under it to the extent that the people of Gaza will not get what they need, will not get enough. They will always remain in a suffering situation. They will always remain unable to build or repair what Israel itself damages in their infrastructure and in their environment. But at the same time, it doesn't get them to the situation where the world would look and say, wow, those people are really in a disaster and Israel is horrible. Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, this is really, I would call it, worse than an occupation in so many ways.
Yeah, it certainly has some of the elements that they sometimes people refer rhetorically as like a prison, and it certainly does have that quality, is that those who control the prison control the intake, the nutritional intake of the inmates.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This is Ehad Lotayev, and he worked very hard on this, the various efforts, as the main one to go to is GazaArk.org for details. By the way, you also made a very nice point that there were, I don't know the number, but there were Israelis, some of them former Israeli military, who were part of the Estelle crew, right?
Yes, absolutely. Out of the 30 people that were on the Estelle, there were 5 who were Jews. 3 of those carry Israeli citizens, are Israeli citizens till today, and one of them had renounced his Israeli citizenship quite some years back in objection to Israeli policies. Mm-hmm. So, again, this came in the article because of the continual claiming that any effort to support the Palestinian is stemming from anti-Semitic beliefs. And this is another abhorring tactic that the Zionists and their supporters go to right away as soon as there is an attack on Israel. We had to make it very clear that this is not and has never been an effort related in any way to any kind of racism, mm-hmm. anti-Semitism or other, has no place in our movement, we are actually totally against that. And I said it clearly. Let's pay attention to the other kind of racism that exists around the Palestinian cause, which is not the anti-Semitism, but the strong belief that is widespread and really practiced by a lot of Israelis that the Arabs, the Palestinians, are lesser people. This is a practically existence and existing and a racism that has effects on the ground today and that nobody's talking about. Let's talk about this.
Exactly. Well, Ehad, we really congratulate you on your work, and Jim Manley has been. I assume he's going to be touring. Am I right to think that? I'm hoping that some of these people who criticize him will give him a forum in which he can discuss with them what he thinks.
He will be touring. The one thing we have to keep in mind with all good intentions is Jim's age and Jim's situation. I mean, thankfully he is in great health for his age, but he's still 79 years old. Actually, he's 80 this week. He's going to be 80 in a couple of days. So
we'll all wish him a happy birthday.
Yes. we all will, and we'll convey to him your birthday wishes as well.
Thank you.
So he will be touring, and we'll announce in advance his schedules, and hopefully, as you said, hopefully those who just want to criticize him will give him a chance to talk about in his own words, rather than just concluding what they want to conclude on their own and making it as if it's their truth.
Yeah, very good. Canadians would really benefit from it. And thank you very much, Ehad, for your time, and we look forward to talking to you again sometime in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
GazaArk.org. GazaArk.org. I'm sure you can spell that. But we're going to take a quick break And we will come back, and we hope we'll be able to get our friend Hoyle on the line. And this is us, Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Hey, but you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and we have a website, taylor-report.com, where these our programs are made available, so you can go back and check and catch up on things. We hope to be speaking shortly with David Hoyle, and of course later we're going to also talk to Zafar Benghazi, pretty much a focus on the crisis in the Middle East. Phil Conlon is just telling me that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the poet, is taking our suggestion to quit accepting prizes.
You talk about it one day, and the next day it's in the newspapers. He was offered a prize by European Pen for his lifelong contribution. He said no. He says this prize has money from the Hungarian government, and they suppress people's liberties, this government, and their civil liberties. They suppress writers. They do other bad things, and I'm not taking your money because I don't want anything from them.
We know for sure the Roma have really caught it from that government, and it's an ugly situation there. And hey, good.
And he's 92 years old, by the way. He says, I don't want your prize.
By the way, I remember him very well. He would have been doing that when he was 17. You're right. He's not interested in prizes. He understands that there's politics in prizes. I give my favorite example. Jean-Paul Sartre turned down the Nobel, and William Saroyan turned down the Pulitzer. And he said, no thanks. Anyway, because he said, look, I'm a writer. I'm not running for something. And I think we have David Hoyle. Are you there, David?
Yes, I am, Phil.
Hey, David, thank you very much. We were telling our listeners that this was started off as a mysterious incident, but it quickly seems to be, at this point, confirmed that Israeli planes bombed some type of munitions, I guess, plant in Sudan. Can you tell us what's going on here? What happened, what's the explanation, if you've got one?
Well, it's always very difficult to work out exactly what's happened, especially in that part of the world, and given the players who may have been involved. But it all points to the fact that the Israeli Air Force actually did attack sort of arms factory or munitions depot, I think, in the south of Khartoum, the capital of mm-hmm. Sudan. Lots of speculation, of course, as to exactly what motivated it. There have been, of course, two or three other incidents over the last 2 years.
I can recall we interviewed you, and you spoke of this. A convoy of some type was attacked.
On the Red Sea coast of Sudan. The allegations, I think, actually coming out of Israel as motivation for the attack is that there is a strong link actually between the government of Sudan and Hamas in the occupied territories. And I think they have claimed they are sort of interdicting a weapon. Yeah, a pipeline, in effect, actually from Sudan into Palestine.
How can they be so madly cavalier to attack a sovereign country? It's telling us something about the power configuration in the region that they could just do that. I mean, I don't recall them making a case before any international forum laying a foundation for why they might attack if this were bad behavior were to continue. I don't see.
Well, that's all true. That's absolutely true. I mean, there presumably actually was no warning. There were no ultimatums. You know, I think the Israelis appear to have acted on what they perceived to have been intelligence on this alleged arms link. Mm-hmm. But it's not been raised in any fora that I'm aware of. And, you know, it's not, of course, the first time that there have been attacks like this on other sovereign countries. You know, mm-hmm. a number of neighboring countries have been attacked without any warning.
Now,
authority.
I can recall moments in the past where similar episodes have happened involving other countries where everyone dashed to the Security Council or to the United Nations and stood up in front of them and gave speeches saying, this has happened to us. You know, there has to be... Is Sudan going to take this matter up, and are they, and what is the response?
I was actually talking with a number of the analysts actually in Sudan earlier. Yes, I think they will go through that, you know, down that route. They will actually talk to the powers that be within the UN, and you know, the issue will be raised at that level. Exactly what happens and what the actual result of it will be. Of course, I think, you know, we have a history of nothing happening with the UN. The UN Security Council for a certain, you know, political benefit, not actually doing anything, you know, to address these issues historically. So I think Israel will not really, you know, feature much in terms of condemnation.
What about the one of the things I've seen is, and there seems to be a kind of a smirking great power way of treating this coming from Israel, where high-ranking retired people are talking about how, well, this might have been a kind of a practice run for something they would do to Iran. According to the Sudanese, it was very sophisticated aircraft involved. What about also, was there connivance of other states? Wouldn't they flew over some other people's territory to get there?
They certainly did, and it's hard not to imagine that Washington, you know, wasn't informed. Obviously, they would have actually flown over a number of Middle Eastern countries and African countries. So it's actually very likely that there was a certain degree of information that should pass on. But again, you know, probably not as much as the general public might think. As a rule, I think certain countries are notified literally as their airspace is actually entered into or as the action is taking place.
Yes.
That may have also been the case with Washington. I think they were certainly notified, but I don't think it was actually, you know, in the opening phases.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to David Hoyle, European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. That's ESPAC.org, a wonderful site full of the information. And by the way, dealing with matters, the previous attacks are discussed at that site. Of course, the most famous one was the United States itself firing. It was Bill Clinton fired missiles. Is there no... I've heard or read that the Sudanese leaders have said things like, well, we reserve the right to... respond, I think the expression was equivalent of in kind, but that's not very likely, is it?
I don't think it is. I mean, at the end of the day, there's not a huge amount of options which Sudan would have in that regard. Their best bet is to, you know, go through the motions of registering the protests and complaints, you know, exactly the fashion you mentioned. And obviously the UN is one of the fora. There are sort of other regional fora, the African Union, the Arab League, and so on and so forth. There's no doubt, you mentioned the Al-Shifa incident. That was an example of the Americans actually getting it absolutely wrong. You know, they hit a pharmaceutical factory and an aspirin factory, and then actually went through this ridiculous facade that in fact it was an arms factory. The factory actually that was attacked, I think, in South Khartoum, probably in this instance was an arms factory. I mean, Sudan has actually quite a large arms industry.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, unfortunately, it's been caught up in war for
50
years. So, it's, you know, that has been one of the byproducts of that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that Sudan actually gained a huge amount of sympathy after the Al-Shifa attack back in 1998. They played all their cards right in that sense. And I think, you know, they will actually probably try and get that sort of a response internationally as well after this attack.
Yeah. Now, their government has been under a kind of siege in that certainly Washington works very hard to make President Bashir uncomfortable, and they have him under charges at the International Criminal Court. There's been these problems with South Sudan, and there's been talk about how stable the situation are. Would there be that element, or do they think that this might bring about his downfall or problems for him? He's going to have a problem explaining to his people not doing much, right?
Well, that's the only real aspect of this which might actually cause him in some problems. Problems. At the same time, of course, it may well be a very convenient rallying point. So I'm not absolutely convinced it's going to be a negative for him internally. I mean, since I began watching Sudan and working on the issue of Sudan, which is actually from back in 1996, every single month Sudan has been in crisis, military crisis, economic crisis, political crisis. And the same government somehow has actually managed to get through all of these issues.
That's what they do. Crisis is what they do.
Well, I mean, I think it's an extraordinary case study of crisis management on the hoof, because this government came into power as a result of a bloodless coup in 1989, and as I mentioned, every month you've had quite immense difficulties which they've actually tackled. So this is the latest in that. I don't think it's going to cause the Bashir government any difficulty internally. I think it will probably, as mentioned, be used as a focal point for rallying around the nation. So I think, as mentioned, if they do play their cards right, it should also get them
might strengthen them.
Sympathy vote.
Yeah. This is David Hoyle, European Sudanese Public Affairs Council, ESPAC.org. And lastly, David, I remembered when this occurred that something that has been underreported, there are Africans and apparently a number of Sudanese who've tried to become refugees in Israel. And the reports are they're really badly treated. Do you know anything about their situation, and can you tell us, if you do, what it is about the Sudanese who've made their way to Israel and what happens to them?
Well, it's actually been literally quite extraordinary in many ways, because, as you know, within the western region of Sudan, Darfur, there's been a very sort of ongoing conflict since 2004, and as a result of that, you've had thousands of black Sudanese, black African Sudanese, who've actually left Darfur as refugees. Many of them have actually undergone incredibly difficult journeys, actually through Egypt, through Sinai, and then into Israel, and all accounts, as you say, of how they've been handled and treated by Israel, are rather disturbing, especially given the sort of international the attempts in certain international quarters to say what's happening in Darfur was a genocide. Mm-hmm. You would have expected that a country that actually came out of a genocide, such as Israel, would have actually treated these people in a better way. I mean, it's not been a good record, unfortunately, in that instance. And whether you are pro the motivations of the refugees actually leaving Sudan or not, once they were in that situation, they had certain rights, and those rights don't appear to have been respected, sadly.
Yeah, no. And by the way, the reports I saw were coming from the Israeli media themselves.
That's absolutely correct.
And they said that, it's kind of things we associate with apartheid governments or segregation in the American South, a real racial dislike and alienation.
It's very, very disturbing. Yeah. And it's hard to work out exactly what is motivating them.
Well, the major media is helping us by not telling us a word about it.
Well, I think it has actually been, you know, covered sporadically in the some of the world media, but it's a very, you know, sad and disappointing sideline of a conflict in Darfur.
Yeah. Well, David Hoyle, we're really grateful you had the time, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thank you very, very much.
It's a pleasure, Bill.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's David Hoyle, ESPAC.org, European Sudanese Public Affairs Council. And Phil has an announcement. There's something going on tonight, 7 o'clock in Toronto.
7 o'clock at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. And this is Beyond Refugee Health Cuts, Examining the Roots and Nurturing Resistance. And this has to do, deals with the issue of Harper, in a very mean-spirited way, cutting back medical coverage for refugee applicants. The speakers will be from the Roma Community Center, the Immigration Legal Committee of the Ontario Law Union, and Mexicans United for Regularization and Health for All. An interesting mix of groups. That's 7 o'clock at the Steelworker Hall, 25 Cecil Street.
And I'm really glad they're doing it, and we will try to cover that too. I think that the Roma story is one that we should be watching. It's a very dangerous one, because in Europe, Central Europe, we are seeing conduct and attitudes and signs that are very much resemble the 1930s. And you know, people always say, "Oh, how could that have happened?" Well, as this meeting tonight will show, it tends to happen rather easily and without anybody quite noting until it gets into more dangerous phases. So it's 25 Cecil Street tonight, 7 o'clock in Toronto. And shortly we will be talking to Zafar Ben-Gash. I'll just tell you by way of introduction, Zafar is the editor of Crescent International, and we've had him on previous piece. He's traveled in the Middle East and to all these countries like Sudan we're just speaking of, and Turkey, and we have been trying to follow and situation in Syria. In the last few days, we had this little comedy, dark comedy, about how there was going to be a ceasefire. We all understood that was not going to happen. The fact is that the so-called Free Syrian Army are a bunch of cutthroats, and they have a lot of money behind them. But I don't want to take the information out of the mouth of the man himself, Zafar Ben-Gash. There's Zafar.
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much for joining us. I was just saying that there was some hope that there would be a ceasefire in Syria. It seemed to be in good faith, I'm going to say, on the part of the government, but I don't think anybody actually believes this so-called Free Syrian Army is capable of agreeing to anything. I don't know if it even has a leadership. Can you tell?
Well, you put your finger on the problem. Basically, there are so many different groups that they simply... nobody can speak on behalf of all of them. When the UN and Arab League envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi, announced that the Syrian government had agreed to a ceasefire, although they said that they would like to make sure that the other side or sides also agree to it, Mr. Brahimi had indicated that he had assurances from the rebel groups that they would abide by the ceasefire if the government were to do so. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what we noticed was that there were conflicting statements being issued by various leaders of the rebel groups. So one person would say, we will abide by the ceasefire, and then he would say, local commanders have to make their own decisions. which indicates that particular commander, or even though he claimed to be a leader of the Free Syrian Army, had absolutely no control over local commanders or people on the ground. That's one part of the problem. The other is that, according to our information, about 80% of the fighters in Syria are foreign mercenaries, and they have no particular interest in adhering to a ceasefire. You see, the ceasefire was proposed for the time period when Muslims were celebrating Eid al-Adha, which is the Eid that is linked, or it occurs at the same time as the Hajj pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
So if there were Syrian fighters over there, they would have an interest in maintaining a ceasefire so that they could go to their families, etc., and celebrate Eid with them. But when it comes to these foreign fighters, these mercenaries, whether they are from Afghanistan or Chechnya or Pakistan or Algeria or Tunisia or wherever else they may be, or Saudi Arabia, they are away from home, and for them, a ceasefire would be a waste of time because they cannot go back home. They can't do anything. They can't join their families. So they say, well, why don't we just continue fighting?
Yeah, and by the way, Zafar, I think you were also pointing at something that maybe is under-discussed. You use the word mercenary, and indeed, they are. In the, we know that Qatar and Saudi Arabia said they would pay.
Yes.
And so, the you know, every day you work, you get paid.
Exactly.
There's that. But also, their motivation has nothing to do with ideology or anything else. And once somebody says, I'm doing this for the money,
yes,
you can forget every other thing they say.
Exactly. In fact, there is proof, and this has been admitted by some of these mercenaries, that they get paid $150 in cash per month. That is not per day, but that's still quite a lot of money in that environment when they get their arms and their bullets and guns and food for free.
Inevitably, there will be bonuses for certain behavior.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. So the greater the mayhem that they can create over there, the more reward they would get. So in that sense, regrettably, much as this ceasefire proposal was a very good idea, and many people had hoped that this would then lead to some kind of an opportunity to initiate a political dialogue, regrettably, that is not going to be the case, because, as I mentioned, if 80% of the rebel fighters are foreign mercenaries, then they have no particular desire in maintaining a ceasefire. So again, we see this picture that is now becoming clear in Syria, that only 20% of the fighters are Syrians themselves. That means the Syrians, the overwhelming majority of them, do not want this conflict to continue. There is only a very small number of them, naturally a diehard core group of people, but even they are not under any specific chain of command. So there also we have the problem that for the Syrian government, the difficulty is that even if they want to have a ceasefire, even if they want to initiate a political dialogue, the question is, who should they go to? Who should they talk to?
Yes.
And even if they talk to somebody, whether that particular person or that particular group has the authority to be able to bring other people on board and bring other people to the negotiating table. Mm-hmm. So this is the situation and the dilemma that we face in Syria at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
But I also want to add something else, and that is that the foreign sponsors of these mercenaries, be it Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, or even the U.S. to some extent, and the French, of course, they're also involved. Of these groups, of these countries, Saudi Arabia and Turkey have, I think, at long last realized that it is virtually impossible to overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. So now they're talking in terms of alternative scenarios in which perhaps some kind of a face-saving formula for them, that is, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, can be found.
Mm-hmm.
So Turkey, for instance, has proposed that they would be willing to accept a solution in which Farouk al-Shira, who is currently the vice president of Syria, would take over from Bashar al-Assad. Saudi Arabia has indicated that they would like somebody within the Turkish military to, I beg your pardon, the Syrian military to take over so that they could restore some semblance of normalcy. Now, obviously, both of these proposals are unacceptable to the government in Syria because they have all along maintained that the chaos and the mayhem in Syria has been caused by outside players who have instigated it. They are financing it. They are arming these mercenaries. They are smuggling them into Syria. And so we are left with no choice but to defend our country and to continue fighting until we have driven out these mercenaries out of Syria. I also want to add something else, and this is something that I have observed and I have been informed by very knowledgeable sources, that the mercenaries, particularly from places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, are actually flown via Dubai and Abu Dhabi into Beirut. And then in Beirut, there are pro-Saudi elements. They are essentially concentrated in the northern city of Tripoli. And the other town is Sidon, which is immediately south of Beirut. These pro-Saudi elements and also pro-Qatari elements of, within Lebanon act as facilitators for transferring these mercenaries into Syria. And anybody who has traveled, as I do very frequently, if you pass through Dubai or Abu Dhabi airport and you check flights going to Beirut, it is surprising that you find a very large number of Afghans and Pakistanis flying on those flights going to Lebanon. Now you begin to wonder, I mean, what are these people doing in Lebanon? Yes. That was never the case. So it is a clear indication that that is the route that is being used to smuggle these people. Of course, that's not the only route. There are others as well. Turkey, of course, is a major smuggling route for these foreign mercenaries, as well as Jordan. That is actually using Chechens, because many Chechens in the past settled in Jordan, and there are literally tens of thousands of Chechens over there. So the Chechens from Chechnya, from the North Caucasus, who are now joining these mercenary forces, come in from there, they come to Jordan, they meet their fellow Chechens, and then they are smuggled into Syria.
What a story. This is Zafar Bengash, crescent-international.net.
Sorry, crescent-online.net.
Ooh,
crescent-online.net, yes. That's okay.
I'm going to take your word for it because you happen to be the guy running it. So, Zafar, this is all engrossing, but I realize I better ask you a couple other things. Now you've raised Qatar.
Yes.
Could you tell us, apparently, is he the emir or the prince or whatever Qatar has visited Gaza?
Yes.
And do you think maybe this will scramble the brain of Harper? Because he likes Qatar, and he likes all the monarchs of the Gulf.
Yes.
And but meanwhile, I understand that the Gazans weren't themselves very impressed. They tried to have a rally at a football stadium and had to call it off because the Gazans didn't want to go.
Right.
Do you know about this visit? What do you make of that?
Yes, of course. First of all, this visit obviously had the blessings of the U.S. and Israel, because the week prior to his visit to Gaza, the Israelis had been bombing the place and attacking, and they had killed about seven or eight Gazans in the week prior to that. So obviously the visit had U.S. and Israeli blessings. Now, Qatar naturally is obviously punching way above its weight. Not that the emir is...
They don't have any weight, do they?
Well, the emir himself is a pretty big fellow. He's grossly overweight.
Oh, yeah, he personally. Yeah.
But, I mean, you're right. Like, you know, Qatar is a tiny country, but it's a very rich country. Just to give you some idea, I mean, the total population of Qatar is 1.87 million. out of whom only 300,000 are citizens. The others are all foreign workers, mainly from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, etc. And of course, in the Middle East, in these countries, they don't give them citizenship, even if they've been working there for 50 years.
No, it's serfdom, right? I mean, there are contract workers. They could be fired in a moment.
Exactly. So the reason why the Qatari emir, Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, was sent to Gaza was, number one, that there is a sinister plan underway to try to diminish or undermine Iran's influence in the region. Because in the past, obviously, Iran was a very staunch supporter of the Palestinian cause. It still is. But the Qatari emir was sent in order to take away the Hamas-led government from its close relations with Iran and bring it into the so-called moderate Arab camp. Now, the Emir of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, etc., these are referred to as moderate Muslims, although they are the ones that are financing all the mercenaries in Syria. But so long as that serves Western imperialist policies, then they are automatically moderate.
Yes.
So the Qatari Emir's visit essentially was aimed at that at the geostrategic level. Naturally, the Hamas government would do with any help that they can get because they are in desperate situation. They have been under Israeli siege since 2007. You will recall that as soon as the Hamas government or Hamas took over control of Gaza in June of 2007, when they drove the Fatah thugs from there because Hamas had won the elections, and yet Fatah, which works as a agent of the Israeli government, when the Hamas fighters drove them out of here, then Canada was the first country of all the countries in the world to stop all aid to the Palestinians. So there was $30 million in the pipeline. The Harper government immediately stopped all that help, although that money was going to help the Palestinian people, mm-hmm. who, according to UN figures, 80% of the people of Gaza are food deficient. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of the Israeli assault on Gaza in December of 2008, January 2009, virtually the entire infrastructure of Gaza, about 5,000 homes, hospitals, mm-hmm. schools, etc., have been destroyed. Even bakeries have been destroyed. And since they cannot import any steel or cement into Gaza because of the blockade, so those buildings stand as ruins. Now, the Qatari emir went there, and he gave them a check for $400 million to rebuild Gaza, and they're going to build a new city which would be named after the emir of Qatar. It will be called Hamad City. But there is a catch there. You see, you can give somebody money. I mean, you can give money to the people of Gaza, but how do they rebuild their homes or hospitals, whatever, unless they can import steel and cement. Mm-hmm. So that is where That's the catch. Now that's where Egypt would come in. Yeah. Now if Egypt were to help with this, I'm surprised actually that the new Egyptian government has not been as forthcoming as I would have expected them to be. They open the Rafah crossing with Gaza periodically. They don't allow free flow. Sometimes it gets shut down again. And they have even, the Egyptian government, the new Egyptian government, has also destroyed all of the tunnels that the Palestinians had dug through which they used to smuggle in some medicines, a little bit of food or whatever they needed, that they have all been destroyed. And yet the Egyptian government would not allow or not open the Rafah crossing so that desperately needed food and medicines can be taken into Gaza. And I also was wondering when this announcement was made or when I read that the Qatari emir had gone to Gaza, although it was a short visit, only 6 hours, and then he dashed back into Egypt, as to why the Egyptian president has gone to visit Gaza. I mean, after all, they have a common border there.
Well, that's unfortunately going to be the mystery question. We have to leave it. Why didn't he go? And please, I hope we get you back next week and we'll finish this. This is a very involved story, and we really appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure.
This is Zafar Ben-Gaz. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So for Phil Condon and Carol, this is Phil Taylor, CIUT 89.5 FM. See you next week.